As I was getting ready to fly here, a friend sent me an article from one of our most prestigious universities. If you're familiar with the phrase Ivy League in America, it's a group of about a dozen universities, of which Harvard, Yale, and Princeton are all a part. We all have those sorts of universities in our countries, and very well respected. Well, at one of those schools, University of Pennsylvania Medical School, just recently, they did some testing with five women, and these five women went through brain imaging while they were speaking in tongues. How many of you know what I mean by speaking in tongues? All right, just a few of you. And they were measuring their brain, they were doing a brain scan at a medical school to see if it could be explained what was happening in their brains while they were doing this. And they located the part of the brain where most activity was happening. And they said it's a part of the brain where some of it is under our control, but they don't know where all the control comes from. And one of the ladies said, well, that's because when we speak in tongues, the Holy Spirit comes into us. And the scientists were saying, yeah, okay, well, whatever. We don't see that in the brain scans, but we can't trace where this is coming from either. And this was written up, in a journal. Lately, we've had a number of claims of healing in medically documented circumstances. Mayo Clinic professors, and so on. It's our most prestigious hospital system. And they've written these up in journals. And they've had instant disappearance, within 5 minutes, disappearance of brain tumors after prayer. And they've imaged MRI, CAT scan, x-rays, whatever is appropriate. They would image before and after, and they could tell something's going on. And these have just come out. We just recently had a large book published, 1,100 pages, with thousands of these claims from around the world. And one of the main claims in the book is the Western world, the Western scientific world, is the last to catch up on these things, but the rest of the world already knows about it. The universities and the rest of the world. In fact, it was called, throughout this two-volume work, it was called the majority worldview versus the minority worldview. And the minority view world was the Western world. Well, this is all very strange. And some of these things are discussed. For example, here's one of the cases in this book. A baby was born with a club foot. A bone that's not developed, and the child can't walk properly. And they were taking the child in for surgery to open the foot up. And the minister came in at the last moment and said, can I pray for the child one more time? And the medical doctor said, sure, but you kind of have to make it fast because we've got the operating room and we've got to go. So the pastor laid hands on the child and prayed. And the medical doctor said, I kind of cheated. I kept my eyes open, and I watched the little foot open right up in front of my eyes, and we didn't do surgery. The child was fine. Go, well, that doesn't sound like any modern medicine I know. We've had experiments with double-blind prayer testing in hospital settings, two major hospitals, one in the middle of our country and one out in San Francisco, where one worked with 2,000 patients, one worked with 400 cardiac patients. It was double-blind. Nobody knew who was being prayed for. The 400 heart patients in San Francisco, they got a fund for this, to write it up, this prayer effect healing, but double-blind prayer. So you can't claim that the persons who were healed, quote-unquote, knew they were being prayed for, so they got better psychosomatically, because nobody knew, even the doctors did not know who was being prayed for. And the head of the study, his department head, said, "Will you try to publish this material, even if it comes out negatively?" And the cardiologist said, "Sure, whatever it is, we'll submit it to the journal." Well, they surveyed patients in 26 categories, and the PRACY, you know, the paragraph at the beginning of the article, it was published in a peer-reviewed secular medical journal. It was called the Southern Journal of Medicine. You can get it online. The author's name is Randolph Byrd, B-Y-R-D. And it was published in 87-88. And the PRACY of the article, published in the medical journal, says, "We monitored the patients in 26 categories, and those who were prayed for in a double-blind manner got statistically better in 21 out of 26 categories." And then this last sentence, which sounds kind of sectarian, kind of non-politically correct, but the last sentence was, "The results of this double-blind experiment are consistent with prayer to the Judeo-Christian God," because those who were doing the praying were Christians. So that's the way they wrote it up. Well, other universities have done other double-blind prayer testing, and they've used a variety of prayers. Now, I myself don't think that Christians are the only ones whose prayers are answered. I think we have enough evidence of that. But the only other study with 2,000 patients, double-blind prayer, written up in a medical journal, was also with Christian patients, and they also got Christian prayers, and they also got very good results. But one of them that had a mix and match kind of prayer team from all different kinds of religions and gurus and I think a witch doctor, and it was kind of odd. It was one of our best university hospitals. And the result was that if you were prayed for by this group, you had a slightly less chance than average to be healed. So don't be prayed for. Not by this group, anyway. They don't have a handle on what's going on. Okay, so some of these medical healing things have made their way into journals, even medical journals. Double-blind prayer, this case, this experiment with speaking in tongues. One time, I'm a head of a philosophy department, and one time I got a brochure that came across my desk. "Please put this up on your bulletin board." And it was on medical science and the spiritual effects of meditation and this and that, prayer. I thought, what goofy group is this saying medicine backs this up? And I kept opening the brochure all the way down, and you know what it said at the bottom? "Sponsored by Harvard University Medical School." I thought, times are really changing that you could see this kind of thing. Now, that little introduction. One of the areas that I do the most work in is near-death experiences. I'm a peer reviewer for the only peer-reviewed world journal in near-death experiences. It's decidedly not Christian. I mean, it's interreligious all over the world. Many, many different accounts from China, India, and as this book of healing is called, the greater world perspective, as opposed to the majority world perspective, as opposed to ours in the West. And we get a lot of claims, as we just got one a couple days ago, new article, on two British, one a cardiologist, a British cardiologist, and one a nurse with a PhD in nursing, and they just wrote up an evidential case of NDEs. And there are a lot of these. They've been written up in more than 20 different medical journals. Now, they're not all positive. Some are critical of them. They think they can reproduce them. But there's a growing trend in NDE research to look for cooperative cases. Now let me explain what I mean by a cooperative case. Let's say we're sitting here in this room and there are no windows. And somebody has a cardiac arrest. Not heart arrhythmia or abnormal heart phenomena, but a real cardiac arrest. When the near-death research first started in the 1970s, a lot of the medical researchers were most interested in cases that measured by the EKG and EEG, where patients were flat heart or flat brain. Now, flat heart and flat brain, as you folks, I'm sure, know way better than I do, doesn't mean there's not necessarily, doesn't exclude all kinds of energy. But, for example, in the EEG, it's no measurable upper brain function. Well, now they know, just as fairly recent, now they know that in cardiac arrest, in a real cardiac arrest, you will have a flat EEG, sorry, flat EKG pretty quickly, but that you'll have a flat EEG in 20 to 30 seconds. So if a person is 1 minute into a cardiac arrest, they supposedly have no upper brain function or heart function. Now, you can tell me if this is true or not. This is, you know, your area. But I have a number of emails from university medical professors who said, yes, this is what they've affirmed. And so if a person is 5 minutes into an NDE after a confirmed cardiac arrest, that's fairly important for their, you know, what they can perceive mentally. Now, let's say we're in a room and there's no windows, and somebody has a cardiac arrest, and they're involved for a few minutes. And the paramedics come, and they work on the person, and let's say they get things stabilized in about an hour. Well, you know, this started at 12:20, and they get things stabilized and ready to take the person away in the hospital. And the person comes to and says, I don't know what you're all worried about. I saw the person lying there on the floor. I didn't even know it was me. You're all gathered around them, and people start beating on me. I just kind of ignored it, because after all, we judge ourselves by where our point of consciousness was. And I was standing up above you, watching you. It's like I was on a ladder or something, looking down. And I got kind of bored, to tell you the truth. And I kind of slipped outside this wall, and I kind of looked some things over out here. And they report something that happened. Let's say a car accident two buildings away. And now I'm making this one up, although there's a lot of evidenced ones with evidence like data like this. And they say, well, I don't know what that guy was thinking in that red car, but he ran the stop sign and he hit the other person, and it was totally his fault. Now, we have a police report, a campus police report from, you know, 1240, 1250, and the person was, as far as anybody knows, without measurable brain or heart activity during that time, but yet they're reporting something that's somewhere else. Experiments have been done, largely in Western Europe, actually. A number of experiments have been done where in operating rooms now, they're putting random, constantly changing digits up by the ceiling, and asking people who say they have had an NDE, did you see a red number up there on a computer? And the number continually changes randomly. And they haven't had anybody who's claimed to have an NDE see the number, but they had in an experience, a previous experience from someone who claimed to be able to induce these states, they correctly read the random number. So that happened at a California University of Southern California. So, in a number of these cases, I mean, I could sit up here for the rest of the day and tell you, because a couple of researchers, one in particular, she's the editor of the Journal for Near-Death Studies, and she works in the counseling psychology department of a Texas university. And she has recently published 100-plus evidential NDE cases. Now, let me give you an actual one instead of this make-believe one of seeing an accident. A little girl drowned in the northwestern U.S., and she was without pulse for 19 minutes. She was underwater. She was pulled out of a pool and taken to an emergency room. there were two doctors on duty. One was a pediatric brain specialist. He'd done specific work on child brain issues, but he was a pediatrician. And they were there, and they tried to resuscitate the gal. But she had no brainwave readings, no gag reflex, fixed and dilated pupils. They couldn't do anything much with her. They hooked her up to the machines, put her in ICU, and her folks went home for the evening. She came to spontaneously 3 days later. I say spontaneously. They didn't do anything additional to her. She was hooked up. She came to, and she looked up with the doctor who was in the room, and she said, "Oh, you're the guy that saved me. Thanks. Where's the tall, skinny doctor without the beard?" And he said, "I'll get him for you." Thinking, what the heck? And this guy's an agnostic, the pediatrician. So he went down the hall, and he got his doctor buddy, came back, and she talked for 1 hour, and they're taking notes. And they said, "How do you know we resuscitated you? I watched you." "What do you mean?" "I watched you doing the things you did to me. Where were you?" "Up by the ceiling." "Okay, do you remember the room you were in?" "Yes, I do." "What was it like?" So she draws, they started letting her draw pictures. And this is over here, and this is over here, and this is over here, and you guys came in from this door, and a nurse did this, and so on. And they're just sitting there going, this is crazy. And her parents got there to the hospital, and they came in, and before they came in, she'd said to them, she said, "I spent time with an angel named Elizabeth." Well, there's no scientific test for Elizabeth. But she said, "Elizabeth allowed me to look into my home, and I could see what my folks were doing that night." I said, "Okay, what was your dad doing?" "Well, he was sitting here and he was doing this." "What'd your daughter do? I mean, sister do? What'd your brother do?" "Thanks. What was your mother doing?" She said, "My mom was cooking dinner." I said, "Okay, there's a contact point with the real world." Said, "What was your mom making?" She said, "Roast chicken and rice." Okay, roast chicken and rice. The family got there. "Sir, where were you sitting the other night? What was your son doing, if you remember? What was your daughter doing?" "Ma'am, what'd you make for dinner?" "It was 2 nights ago. I just threw some rice and chicken together." Okay, but she's comatose. No brain activity, no measurable brain activity. And so this is written up in a pediatric journal. And this same medical doctor wrote in another medical journal, he gives about 10 of these cases that present some data that this person had some kind of consciousness. Now, in some of these cases, the person has no heart activity for up to 45 minutes, measurable heart activity. Or with one major cardiologist, I don't know if I want this to be said of my cardiologist, but he said more near-death patients than any other medical doctor. I think those implications are a little frightening. But he said 2,500 patients near death, and he just started keeping an informal check, and 1,600 of them claimed to have had experiences, some measurable, a lot not. And 57 of them reported experiences with flat EEG readings, because he uses EEG and open heart surgery. And so he produced these. And some of these are just truly amazing cases. There's been a study of NDEs in the blind, where folks who are congenitally blind from birth, the only time they've ever claimed to see anything is during the NDE. Now the NDE is over, they're stabilized, and they don't see anything anymore. But a few of them have reported data, like down a hallway, or what's happened here and there, that can be verified. Now some of this is very kind of, you know, low level of verification. Some of it's very complicated. What people see in the waiting room on another floor where their family was, and they were drawn to where their family was. We've got a very close family friend who's a physician, and she is the head of our local hospital system's emergency medical system. And she said very early in my training, she said an elderly woman came in and they had to do some immediate work on her heart. She was having some major problems. And she said, we're in the emergency room and we're working on her heart. And she said, the elderly lady, she was in her 80s, came to later after the surgery. And she said, doctor, I was watching you from the ceiling. I was watching you do these procedures to my chest. And she said, I've got a couple questions for you. Why do you keep doing this and putting your hand down? And putting your hand down. And our friend said, you know, she wears blue jeans and a shirt, and she walks around the emergency room, and she's not expecting to do emergency heart surgery, and she gets drawn into these things. And she wears a watch that's loose on her wrist, and she shakes it down like this during the day. So she's working on this woman, and she keeps putting her hand down. The woman said, why do you do that? She said, that's my watch. I'm shaking my watch down. And the old lady, the older lady said, and do you always talk the way you do? And she said, what do you mean? She said, you said some things that weren't very nice. She said, what do you mean? She said, some of your words, you were using some pretty bad language. Ooh. And she said, well, would you mind telling me what I said? And she said, well, my mother taught me not to talk like this, but I'll tell you what she said. And she reproduces exact phrases that this medical doctor is prone to use in everyday life. And she said, I was just a young medical doctor in the emergency room, and I'm confronted with this person who watches me do this and repeats my words, but, you know, her heart wasn't operating. And so she was really surprised. There's a well-known case, by the way, that's been published. I'm thinking about this. There's a case with a Dutch medical doctor where one of the patients in a state where they had to stop, you know, bodily operations while they're working, the person's, you know, had a heart monitor and so on. And when the patient came to, they said, I watched the doctor walk around the operating room like this. He's doing this all the time. What's he doing this for? And the person they reported this to started laughing. And they said, that particular doctor, when they wash up, when they scrub up for surgery, he doesn't like to touch anything. So he puts his arm, he puts his hands under his arms, and he points things out with his elbows. Get that for me. Bring that over here. I want that cart, not that cart, that cart right there. And he points with his elbows while he keeps these under his coat. And the person reported these things. Now, I should tell you too, near-death humor abounds. In one case, a lady was drawn, as I said, to the waiting room. A couple floors away, she was having heart surgery. It was very serious surgery. And her family was down there. And she said, I looked in on my family members, and she said, my brother-in-law was pacing in the room. And she said she heard him mumble, and she confronted him with this later. He said, if she's going to kick the bucket, I hope she hurry up and does it. I have an appointment. So when she came to, she said, appreciate the faith. Yeah. Appreciate you hanging in there with me. In another case, they worked on a lady with a flat EEG. And they did surgery. She died. They worked on her for 45 minutes. They pronounced her dead, pulled the sheet over her head, and called for the attendants to take her to the hospital morgue. They took her, they're pushing down the hallway, and she sat up under the sheet. And they called the physician, they gave her a shot of adrenaline, and they brought her back. But they were, you know, a little amused about this dead body sitting back up again. One case, a lady died, They covered her with a sheet. Scrub nurse came in, cleaning things up in the room. Medical doctor came in, shut the door, started doing some things that you see in the TV hospital movies. Started doing some things with the nurse, and the patient turned him in. Because she said, I was up by the ceiling, and she watched the whole thing. So, now, what I'm suggesting is that with the growth of certain scientific testing and imaging, this New York Times article suggested that we are in for a huge change in medical and biological science. And the fellow said, only Western University professors don't know that the world is different than they perceive. In fact, in a recent survey, a secular survey of 1,100 physicians in our country, 75% of them said they believed in miracles. And when they were asked, have you ever seen anything that, as far as you can tell, just looks supernatural from your subjective viewpoint? And 55% of them said yes. 55% of the medical doctors surveyed, secular survey. So we don't have to do with this. So it's in this world where there seems to be a growing number, and it's very amorphous. I'm not claiming, you know, I can prove this, or this is scientific data that prove all these things. It just looks like we're moving some, kind of toward a worldview that's open to the numinous, that's open to, well, the reviewer, the New York Times article, called it neuro-Buddhism. These people aren't Buddhists, they're just sometimes generally Eastern in their outlook. The world is one, we all share reality together, so on. But it's neurally inclined. It's aided by the latest research in cognitive, what's often called the cognitive revolution. In fact, he ends the article by saying, be sure and understand, a cognitive revolution is afoot in medicine and psychology and psychiatry, and we're either going to be a part of it or we're going to be left behind. But what he said was, we've got these neural Buddhists who are open to general religion. If you say God, they'll go, maybe? I mean, you know, world spirit, some kind of, yeah, I'm okay. Prayer? Yeah, pray. I pray once in a while. Worship? Yeah. Ethics? Yeah, we should behave a certain way. Life after death? Yeah, I mean, you know, look at near-death experiences. There's some kind of afterlife going on. And he said the two worldviews that are vying for supremacy now in the West with the death of naturalism are this neuro-Buddhism and what he calls the biblical worldview. Now, this fellow's not a Christian, the one who writes the article. And he challenged Christians, and he said, you guys believe more, your religious list is longer than the neuro-Buddhist religious list. You believe extra things. God became a man. God is a Trinity. Jesus was raised from the dead. You believe extra things that a general religion doesn't really believe. So, the onus is on you to show your beliefs are true. That's what the article's about. But he's basically calling people to realize that a new kind of religiosity is coming into the West, and it's not anti-science, it's spurred on by science. So, in that little avenue, in the remaining time I have here, I've been lecturing quite widely around your cities. I think you said 15 different venues or something like that in Sweden, on the recent state of studies on the resurrection of Jesus. Now, this isn't medical, it's historical, but something's happening. When I went to graduate school and I did my dissertation at a secular university, I did it on the resurrection of Jesus. And they said, you can do it on the resurrection, but just be careful how you do it. We don't want you saying the resurrection happened because the Bible said so. Find a critical way to use New Testament data the way, say, an agnostic New Testament scholar would use this data. And so I started developing this. And when you ask a normal historical question, you know, what data do we have for Alexander the Great. Well, maybe you're surprised to know that our best, most complete sources for Alexander start at the 300-year mark after his death. Now, that's a long time for people to start reconstructing history when the earliest sources are 300 years later. The best two sources for Alexander are Plutarch and Arrian at plus 400 to 450. Now, in our country, if you were doing a study on the first president of the United States, George Washington, that 400 years hasn't even come yet. I mean, that's an incredibly long time in the past to be telling us what thoughts a person had, to do what's sometimes called historical psychology on a person, and to talk about them. We want early eyewitness sources. The earlier sources, the more credible sources, people who knew him as General Washington, people who knew him as President Washington, what was he like as a person, what kind of policies did he enact, and so on. You want early credible sources. Well, even critics today, I mean, I generally only cite people who are way down on the critical side of the scale. If you divided the folks who comment on the resurrection into conservatives, moderates, liberals, and people who are kind of off the scale, like, for example, Bart Ehrman, who's probably the best, well, is the best-known skeptic in North America. He's a Princeton grad and used to be a Christian, is not a Christian. He said, I am an agnostic, lean toward atheism. I'm definitely not a Christian. But he said, I'll tell you about the data. He said, we've got really good evidence for the life of Jesus, and even this event that Christians call resurrection. He said, we have some surrounding data that are very relevant. For example, historians often tell you that in the ancient world, if you have two separate sources for something, two independent sources, that's excellent. In a lot of ancient historical events, we don't have two sources for. You have one, and you have to kind of reconstruct it. But Bart Ehrman says, the reason nobody questions the crucifixion of Jesus is because we have at least 11 or 12 independent sources. Several are from, four of them, four of the dozen, are from outside the New Testament, and two are non-Christian. And so we have an array of data from believing and unbelieving sources, and Bart Ehrman says this, any historian who studies the data will tell you that we can establish the crucifixion of Jesus. He said, well, that's fine. People die. That's not a big deal. But if you're going to start saying people saw him afterwards, and I'm not calling it a miracle, that involves some other philosophical unpacking. But I'm asking if this person who's pronounced dead was seen later. Bart Ehrman says, we've got some really early sources. Now, a lot of people often march off a timeline. And I'll say, if this is the death of Jesus, a lot of people will say, our best sources are the Gospels, from Mark from about plus 35 years, Matthew from about 50, Luke from 55, and John's the last one for about 65 years. Well, that's fine. I mean, like Bart Ehrman says, he likes to look for historical sources within 100 years of the event. And the oldest of the Gospels is two-thirds of that. But most critics think that the best evidence for the New Testament comes from the Apostle Paul. And Paul writes a lot earlier. Paul writes only 25 years after the cross. And Bart Ehrman says, in Paul and in other sources, we have testimony about the resurrection appearances. Now this would take some unpacking if any of you want to pursue this during the Q&A. But we have material that actually goes back, Bart Ehrman talking, to 1 to 2 years from the cross. So we have historical material that you can write a dissertation on. I mean, it's measurable historically. And the data come from just 1 to 2 years after the cross. You don't have to wait for Mark. I mean, plus 35 is fine. In fact, right now, they have recently found a manuscript. The jury's out on this. I'm not trying to say, oh, we've got it, it's in the bag. No, it's not. But they're doing ancient paleographers. There's only a very few in the world. It's a very specific science that works with ancient documents and puts it in a time frame based on a lot of factors. But they think that they may have found a copy of the Gospel of Mark excuse me, from the first century AD. And if that's what it is, They're handing it around right now. The paleographers are studying it. Mark, the date of Mark could be moved back all the way from 65 to 75, back to 40 A.D., just 10 years after the crucifixion. But even so, Barterman says the Gospels aren't our best sources. Paul, in these early New Testament reports that I could explain for you, but even Barterman says they go back to within 1 to 2 years after the cross. Now, this is just, in historically speaking, it's so intriguing. I'm the guy that does the head count because I get the sources on resurrection and I count sources in German, French, and English. If you could teach me Swedish, maybe we could add some Swedish sources. Hey, you know what? I did just get a Swedish doctoral dissertation the other day that was written in English, so I'm adding that to my bibliography, but it was done here. It was done in the Gospel of Matthew, and what Matthew says about resurrection, and one of your, actually it was a, what country was it? Finland. It was a Finnish university where this Swedish fella, a local Swedish fella, did his dissertation. But I do head count on this, and I can tell you, I know we don't solve things by saying how many people believe what, you know, survey says. But when I went to grad school in the 70s, if you had believed in, say, an empty tomb, or that Jesus claimed to be the vine, you would be in the minority. They would say, you're conservative. Your views are showing. You're conservative. Today, the majority of scholars think that Jesus made those lofty kind of claims. Majority of scholars think the tomb was empty. And the majority of scholars say that the disciples, in some sense, very well-known scholars named Ed Sanders, called himself a liberal, he used to teach at Oxford. He just retired recently from our Duke University. And Sanders says, in a book concerning what scholars concede today, he said virtually every scholar who writes says that after Jesus' death, his disciples saw him again. He says that's accepted by virtually he said it's almost without exception in the New Testament historical community for a fellow who calls himself a liberal. And we get these sources back from the cross. Today, the majority of Western, in the Western university world, the majority of scholars, there are more who believe something happened to Jesus, he showed himself in some sense, than those who believe he didn't. The table totally changed. So I'm just suggesting that maybe what's going on in the New Testament today, it may just be a sign of the times. I don't know. But it might go along with some of these double-blind prayer tests, some of the healings like the club foot, and some claims that are just even way wilder than that. But they've got it on film, in the presence of prayer, and so on. That speaking in tongues example would still flabbergast me. I can't believe that one of our top universities doing brain imaging with speaking in tongues. It just doesn't seem like a medical school does. But I think times are changing, and I think this is a different world. And a lot of you folks are very young, and you're getting your credentials, and you're going to go out in a world that's not quite your grandfather's world. And maybe we should be ready for that, and ready for people to introduce new avenues of the supernatural. And it's a new age because people who are doing this kind of thing almost always claim it can be backed up with scientific testing of one kind or another. EEGs, EKGs, brain imaging, x-rays, CAT scans, MRIs, etc.